Tom is an intensely private person, and he has to be given the number of people who are interested in talking to him. And I haven't met anybody in my professional career that has more of a public following. One of the hallmarks of his research is to expose fallacies, hypocrisies, false knowledge. And how does he do that? Through inductive logic and data. If you're interested or disturbed or confused by a phenomenon that has swept the country, whether it's transgenderism, for example, now, or whether it was 10 years ago, whether it was modern monetary theory or whether it was the woke movement, you could go to Tom Sowell and he would not get emotional about it, either pro or con, but rather he would dissect it analytically in a series of either op-eds, occasional longer essays, podcasts or interviews, or more importantly, in a book. He was totally fearless. In other words, he was not bothered at all. I've never known him to take a position based on what he perceived as the majority position or a position that might enhance him career-wise or financially. He doesn't care. He's a contrarian. He is not convinced that massive government programs have helped the Black community. They feel, therefore, he is not helping them in their careerist aspirations as part of that government project, and therefore they get angry at him. He's not angry at them. He's just saying, this is a misallocation of resources. And you would all be better to switch allegiances and look at other cultural problems or challenges rather than government solution. When you suggest that you're not as strong as you actually are, two things happen. The opponent then becomes emboldened, but more importantly, and Tom is very good on this, this is a theme in all of his work, they develop a contempt for you that you will not exercise a power that's at your disposal. Tom he's very good on that idea that Western powers have to exhibit or make known to enemies what they're capable of if they're pushed, and that will keep the peace. Once they're subject to the consequences of their own bankrupt ideology, they go nuts and they panic and they're deer in the headlights. And that means that these intellectuals have never been around the working class. They don't associate with them. They've never been around minorities. They don't want to be around them. And they create an abstract edifice to square that circle of their apartheid. People who say they have expertise, they have titles before, letters after their name, and they make these arguments from authority, they can be very dangerous people because they're not empirical. And they're not out with the people who are going to experience the effect of their abstraction.
Welcome to the Genius of Thomas Sowell podcast. I'm your host, Alan Wolin.
Generals gathered in their masses, just like witches at black masses. Evil minds that plot destruction, sorcerer of death's construction. In the fields of bodies burning, as the war machine keeps turning. Death and hatred to mankind, poisoning brainwash minds. Oh, Lord, yeah.
The song you are hearing is called War Pigs and was recorded by Ozzy Osbourne and Black Sabbath in 1970. We'll talk more about this song and what it tells us about war later, so stay tuned for that. The voice you heard earlier belongs to Victor Davis Hanson, one of the world's most accomplished classicists and military historians. I'll be talking with Dr. Hansen later in this episode. Dr. Hansen is a close colleague of Thomas Sowell's, and they work together at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. I first heard about Victor Davis Hansen from Sowell's 2010 book, Intellectuals and Society, and I've been reading Hansen's books and columns ever since. So far, I've read four of his books: Mexifornia from 2003, which is about mass Mexican migration into California; The Second World Wars from 2017, which is a deep dive into the military complexities and dynamics of World War II; The Case for Trump from 2019, which is a superbly reasoned plaidoyer for the presidency of Donald Trump; and The Dying Citizen from 2021, which is about the current erosion of the concept of citizenship in present-day America. Intellectuals and Society has a chapter called Intellectuals and War, which, when I first read it back in 2010, precipitated a dramatic paradigm shift in my views on war and the military. In this episode, I will be discussing Sowell's views on war and how we have been taught to think about the subject by our intellectual leaders and educational system. As regular listeners of this podcast will know, music is an important component of my podcasting, and this episode is no exception. To unleash my creative juices for this topic, I dug up the most popular songs since World War II, which deal with the subjects of war and peace. My goal was to learn what America's best songwriters think about war and what messages they are trying to convey to us through their music and lyrics. Interspersed throughout this podcast, I'll be playing clips from a few songs which I feel are noteworthy on the subject. Many of them you will know, some you might not, but they are all classics of the genre, in my humble opinion. So let's begin. I am often asked what my favorite Sowell book is, and I always give the same answer: Intellectuals and Society, published in 2010. There's a chapter in the book called Intellectuals and War, and I can think of no other Sowell discussion which has more dramatically shifted my long-held beliefs about a subject than this one. In his discussion, Sowell looks at the history of World War I and World War II, and the period of calm between these two wars. He also explores the Vietnam War, the first two Iraq wars, as well as the Cold War. His goal is not to judge the rightness or wrongness of these wars, nor to delve into their military aspects. Rather, he explores how intellectuals viewed these wars at the time, and how their views on war in general have changed over the past century. It's a truly fascinating discussion, and I defy anyone to read this discussion and not experience a multitude of aha moments. I know I did. For this episode, I'd like to focus on Sowell's discussion of the causes of World War II. Sowell builds one of the most remarkable cases I have ever heard, and I'd like to share my understanding of it with you today. So here goes. Sowell argues that there were six main causes of World War II. You are not going to believe what these six causes were, because his arguments are so contrary to our common thinking on the subject. I'll go through them one by one. Cause number one, pacifism. Sowell sets up the chapter by explaining how in Europe before World War I, after nearly a century of no major wars in Europe, intellectuals were generally positively inclined toward the idea of war, and they saw in it many positive virtues. Sowell said this:
"In such a time, it was easy for many intellectuals and others to think of war in the abstract, and to find in its excitement and sense of social cohesion and national purpose positive virtues, while its devastating human costs receded into the background of their thoughts. Even those mindful of the carnage and devastation of war could speak, as William James did, of a need for the moral equivalent of war to mobilize people behind a common purpose and common aspirations. It was part of a long-standing assumption among many intellectuals of a dirigiste orientation that it is the role of third parties to bring meaning into the lives of the masses. As already noted, the vision of the anointed is a vision of intellectual and moral elites being surrogate decision-makers, imposing an overarching common purpose to supersede the disparate and conflicting individual purposes and individual decisions of the population at large.
Unfortunately for everyone, World War I was more brutal and destructive than any prior war. 20 million people were killed, and even more were wounded. Of those killed, more than half were civilians. So almost everyone in Europe at the time either knew someone who died in that war or knew people who ended up physically maimed from it. Sowell said this:
"Few had any idea of how modern technology would make this the most lethal and ghastly war the world had yet seen. For both soldiers and civilians alike, how many of the survivors across the continent of Europe would end up hungry or starving amid the ruins and rubble of war, or how many centuries-old empires would be shattered into oblivion by the war, much less what a monstrous new phenomenon, totalitarianism, would be spawned in the chaotic aftermath of that war. Intellectuals were among the many whose illusions would be brutally smashed by the catastrophes of the First World War."
The brutality and devastation of World War I caused an emotional and intellectual backlash against the idea of war, and the intellectuals of Europe and America began to embrace a mood of pacifism. Makes sense, right? Let's not make war anymore. Let's be peaceful. Let's all just get along. What are we fighting about anyway? Intellectuals began to view war itself as the enemy and not other nations. Anti-war novels and the memoirs of veterans became bestsellers. The anti-war German classic All Quiet on the Western Front by German author Erich Maria Remarque sold 72,000 translated copies in only 10 days, and nearly 500,000 copies by Christmas of 1929 in France alone. Remarque is my favorite German author, and when I lived in Germany, I gobbled up over a dozen of his books in their original German. It would be no exaggeration to say that I learned how to speak German from Erich Maria Remarque. Here's a passage in English from All Quiet on the Western Front.
"I am young. I am 20 years old. Yet I know nothing of life but despair, death, fear, and fatuous superficiality cast over an abyss of sorrow. I see how peoples are set against one another, and in silence, unknowingly, foolishly, obediently, innocently slay one another."
Remarque also wrote this:
"A man cannot realize that above such shattered bodies there are still human faces in which life goes its daily round. And this is only one hospital, a single station. There are hundreds of thousands in Germany, hundreds of thousands in France, hundreds of thousands in Russia. How senseless is everything that can ever be written, done, or thought when such things are possible? It must be all lies and of no account when the culture of 1,000 years could not prevent this stream of blood being poured out, these torture chambers in their hundreds of thousands. A hospital alone shows what war is."
The clarity and power of Remarque's writing is unmistakable, and I can totally understand why All Quiet on the Western Front helped to deepen pacifist sentiments in Europe after World War I. The power of a single book is the dream of every author, and Remarque accomplished that dream. Interestingly, what Remarque said about a single hospital, quote, "a hospital alone shows what war is playing out right now as I speak, in Gaza at the Al-Shifa Hospital, which is currently serving as both a hospital for the wounded and a command center for the Gazan military. I encourage you to explore Remarque's books. Several of them have been translated into English. You can even watch the film version of All Quiet on the Western Front on Amazon or Netflix. Don't miss it if you want to understand how one book helped spawn a widespread mood of pacifism, which, according to Sowell, contributed to the start of World War II only 10 years later. But why would pacifism lead to and possibly even cause war. At first blush, this notion seems paradoxical. I'll let Sowell explain it.
In 1926, prominent intellectuals from a number of countries signed an internationally publicized petition calling for some definite step toward complete disarmament and the demilitarizing of the mind of civilized nations. Among those who signed were H.G. Wells and Bertrand Russell in England, and Romain Rolland and Georges Duhamel in France. The petition called for a ban on military conscription, in part to rid the world of the spirit of militarism. Behind such arguments was the crucial assumption that both physical and moral disarmament were necessary to sustain peace. Neither in this petition nor in other statements expressing similar views was there much, if any, expressed concern that both kinds of disarmament would leave the disarmed nations at the mercy of those nations which did not disarm in either sense, thus making a new war look more attractive to the latter because it would look more winnable. Hitler, for example, banned the anti-war classic All Quiet on the Western Front, as he wanted neither moral nor physical disarmament in Germany, but carefully followed both phenomena in Western democracies as he plotted his moves against them.
I have always thought that if you want to understand human behavior, you have to understand game theory. The Oxford Dictionary defines game theory as
the branch of mathematics concerned with the analysis of strategies for dealing with competitive situations where the outcome of a participant's choice of action depends critically on the expected actions of other participants.
So pacifism could theoretically work out just fine, but only so long as all your enemies and opponents also adopt it. If even one opponent eschews pacifism in favor of militarism, then the pacifist strategy is flawed from the start. The song you are hearing is John Lennon and Yoko Ono's 1969 hit single, Give Peace a Chance. I think this song does a great job in very few words to express the pacifist mentality. All we need to do is give peace a chance. I mean, we've tried war all these millennia. Let's give peace a try for a change. And the song has no other lyrics except all we are saying is give peace a chance, over and over again, as if to hypnotize the listener into a meditative state. The pacifist believes that if all peoples would only come together in harmony, there would be no more war, no more suffering, and no more evil. Speaking of harmony, the Boys Choir of Harlem does a terrific job of inspiring us to embrace peace on earth by each of us beginning with ourselves. I actually agree with this message. You can't fix the world until you fix yourself. If only more social activists would take this song to heart. While we are on the subject of boys singing about peace, Sowell talks about the pacifist movement in France between the two world wars. And you'll never guess who played a key role in indoctrinating French youth into a pacifist mindset. I'll let Sowell tell the story.
A key role in the spread of pacifism in France was played by the schools, more specifically by the French teachers' unions, which began organized campaigns in the 1920s, objecting to post-war textbooks favorably depicting the French soldiers who had defended their country against German invaders in the First World War. Such textbooks were called bellicose, a verbal tactic still common among those with the vision of the anointed, of reducing views different from their own to mere emotions, as if in this case only pugnaciousness could account for resisting invaders or for praising those who had put their lives on the line to do so. The leading teachers' union, the Syndicat National des Instituteurs, SN, launched a campaign against those textbooks of bellicose inspiration, which it characterized as a danger for the organization of peace. Since nationalism was said to be one of the causes of war, internationalism, or impartiality among nations, was considered to be a required feature of textbooks. This was not thought of as being against patriotism, but, at the very least, it lessened the sense of obligation to those who had died to protect the nation, with its implicit obligation on members of generations that followed to do the same, if and when that became necessary again.
Just as the French Teachers Union was indoctrinating its country's youth into believing the then fashionable notions about war and peace, so too today does the American Teachers Union feel empowered to indoctrinate American youth into believing a wide range of fashionable causes, from so-called anti-racism to climatism to transgenderism to vegetarianism to anti-Semitism, you name it, they've got an ism for it. So often when Sowell is asked in an interview, "What do you think about this or that?" his response is, "This is nothing new. These ideas go back decades, if not centuries, and they were discredited decades, if not centuries ago." This is one of the great gifts which Sowell gives us, pattern recognition. The thousands of hours he has spent studying history and distilling patterns he has observed, we can download all that wisdom from his brain into our own simply by reading his books. Cause number two, military disarmament. According to Sowell, another cause of World War II was the idea of military disarmament. Advocates of disarmament believe that if only we get rid of the weapons of war, that the likelihood of war would be reduced. Under this vision, the manufacturers of weapons and technology, the so-called military-industrial complex, are viewed as so-called war pigs. As Black Sabbath sings, "Generals gathered in their masses, just like witches at black masses. Evil minds that plot destruction, sorcerers of death's construction."
Generals gathered in their masses, just like witches at black masses. Evil minds that plot destruction, sorcerer of death's construction.
Instead of viewing Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics, and Northrop Grumman as institutions which keep us safe and protected by developing state-of-the-art weapons, we are taught to view them as warmongers who are only out to make money off of people killing each other. Executives of these companies are portrayed by Hollywood as warmongers who are always trying to drag America into more and more foreign wars just for the sake of corporate profits. But is this true? My favorite book about World War II is Victor Davis Hanson's 2017 classic, The Second World Wars. One discussion from that book, which has always stuck with me, was about how America and England both deployed mass-produced four-engine bombers, while Germany and Japan simply didn't have them. They didn't know how to build them. And that this simple fact was one of the reasons the Allies won the war. Victor Davis Hanson said this about four-engine bombers.
four-engine bombers, given their greater drag, complexity, and maintenance, were not always intrinsically better than two-engine models. Intercontinental airliners today, for example, are trending back to employing two rather than four engines, given the vast increases in individual engine power and efficiency. But given the status of aeronautical science in the 1940s to achieve greater bomb tonnage and longer ranges, it was usually necessary to design heavy bombers with four of the standard engines of the era.
One of the great things about the Second World Wars is that it explains in a compelling and easy for the layman to understand way why the technology of weaponry is so important in deciding the outcome of a war. Here's an old song I dug up, which conveys the message that weapons keep us safe and free. It's from 1942, shortly after the attack on Pearl Harbor, and America had declared war on Japan. Another example provided by Victor Davis Hanson is how America had plenty of aircraft carriers, and so did the Japanese, but the Germans did not have a single one. And even if the Germans had had an aircraft carrier, they didn't have any airplanes which could fly onto them. Hanson said this.
The Kriegsmarine, predicated on the idea that battleships might one day challenge Britain at sea, along with Admiral Dönitz's insistence that U-boats could do what surface ships could not, possessed not even a single aircraft carrier. It built just enough heavy surface ships to siphon off precious resources from the army and U-boat fleet, but not enough to pose a serious threat to the Royal Navy. Admiral Raeder illustrated the abyss between Hitler's braggadocio and the military resources of the Third Reich. There were 22 British and French battleships against our two battleships and three pocket battleships. The enemy had over seven aircraft carriers. We had not one, as the construction of our Graf Zeppelin, though nearing completion, was stopped because the Air Force had not even developed suitable carrier planes. The Allied enemy had 22 heavy cruisers to our two and 61 light cruisers to our six. In destroyers and torpedo boats, the British and the French combined could throw 255 against our 34. Indeed, Germany started the conflict with not one heavy bomber. Its navy could deploy only five battleships. There were only 50 submarines that were ready for service, and only 300 Mark IV tanks, the only German model comparable to most French or Soviet counterparts.
The quality and number of weapons make a real difference on the battlefield. If you've ever played paintball, you know what I'm talking about. I would go out on the field with the cheap paintball guns they rent to you. Those guns go pop, 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 and they seem okay when you have nothing to compare it to. But when you're up against the guy who has brought his own state-of-the-art paintball gun, which can fire 10 times as many pellets per second as yours can, you realize you don't stand a chance. Quite apart from the issue of who is a more skilled shooter. Here's what one of the expensive paintball guns sound like. Sowell explains how intellectuals in England and France before World War II were strong believers in unilateral disarmament, advocated in the name of world peace. game theory was ignored, and it was felt that even if Germany were rearming, it still made sense for their own countries to disarm. But how can that be? I'll let Sowell explain.
Almost as remarkable as the lengths to which the pacifists of the 1930s went was the verbal virtuosity with which they downplayed the dangers of the pacifism they were advocating while Hitler was rearming on a massive scale in Germany and promoting the very patriotism among Germans that was being eroded by the intelligentsia in the democracies. Bertrand Russell used an argument that went as far back as 1793, when William Godwin claimed that a country which presented no military threat or provocation to other nations would not be attacked. If Britain would reduce its armed forces, as Bertrand Russell advocated, we should threaten no one, and no one would have any motive to make war on us. Russell explained further, when disarmament is suggested, it is natural to imagine that foreign conquest would inevitably follow, and would be accompanied by all the horrors that characterize warlike invasions. This is a mistake, as the example of Denmark shows. Probably, if we had neither armaments nor empire, foreign states would let us alone. If they did not, we should have to yield without fighting, and we should therefore not arouse their ferocity. According to Russell, if you declare that you are prepared to be defenseless and trust to luck, the other people, having no longer any reason to fear you, will cease to hate you and will lose all incentive to attack you. The reason for this conclusion was Lord Russell's claim, in most civilized men, resistance is necessary to arouse ferocity. From this it followed that fear of an impending war should lead to unilateral disarmament. Such reasoning was not peculiar to Bertrand Russell nor unique to Britain. In France, a book by the head of the French Socialist Party, and later premier, Léon Blum, said, "If a nation thus undertook to disarm, it would not in reality incur any risk, because the moral prestige which it would acquire would render it invulnerable to attack, and the force of its example would induce all other states to follow."
This is a prime example of why intellectuals can be so dangerous to society. They have the ability to construct clever arguments and combine them with verbal virtuosity in order to convince the general public of the most preposterous and dangerous notions. My all-time favorite anti-war song comes from the 1968 Broadway musical Hair. If you've never seen the 1979 film version of this musical, you really must rush out to watch it. It's fantastic. And my favorite song from the film is the last song, called The Flesh Failures. The scene starts with soldiers lining up to march onto a huge troop carrier aircraft to be flown to fight in Vietnam. They are all young, innocent, and naive, seemingly not even sure what they are supposed to be fighting for. The song is then sung by several different men while marching onto the plane. The plane's four propellers start spinning. The soldiers step up into the dark bowels of the massive carrier aircraft. The plane takes off. The next scene we see is a sweeping view over a massive graveyard, then cuts to a close-up of the tombstone of our hero, George Berger. The video ends with real footage of thousands upon thousands of hippie-looking young people protesting for peace at the Washington Monument in Washington, D.C. I'll put a link in the show notes to the full video so you can watch it for yourself. And please do, watch the full film when you can. It's one of the best anti-war films ever made.
Stop, look at one another, short of breath, walking proudly in our winter coats, wearing smells from laboratories, facing a dying nation of moving paper fantasies, listening for the new told lies with supreme visions of lonely tears. Somewhere inside something there is a rush of greatness. Who knows what stands in front of our lives? I fashion my future on films in space. Silence tells me secretly everything, everything.
Call Clause number 3, moral disarmament. In addition to advocating the military disarmament of both England and France before the Second World War, British and French intellectuals were also advocating for the moral disarmament of their fellow citizens. And Hitler was taking careful notes. While All Quiet on the Western Front was topping the bestseller lists in England and France, Hitler banned the book from its native Germany.
Berlin. The date is written in ash. May 10th, 1933. The Oppenplatz was packed. Herr Goebbels arrived around midnight in an open car and made a speech into the shadowy, fire-filled night. He spoke, or more like raved, about the end of Jew intellectualism and giving the German spirit the right of way. And then the students, these young people, drugged on rhetoric and hatred, piled bundles of books onto the fire. I remember one student, his face devil red in the light cast by the flames, holding up copies of this book, which had only been published 4 years before, and which the Führer now pronounced as a disgrace to German soldiers and German manhood. All Quiet on the Western Front by Erich Maria Remarque. I can see the glow to this day and smell again the acrid smoke. Books burn slowly as if defying the heat, as if challenging the fire with the printed word, as if the thoughts on the page were hard rocks, and the flames, the terrible, vengeful, drowning tide of destruction.
Sowell said this about moral disarmament.
Leaders of the drive to rewrite history textbooks called their goal moral disarmament to match the military disarmament, which many regarded as another key to peace. Lists of textbooks targeted for removal from the schools were made by Georges Lapierre, one of the SN leaders. By 1929, he was able to boast of all the bellicose books the SN campaign had gotten taken out of the schools, rewritten, or replaced. Faced with the threat of losing a share of the large textbook market, French publishers caved in to union demands that books about the First World War be revised to reflect impartiality among nations and to promote pacifism.
In the span of only a decade since the end of World War I, the French will to fight had been almost completely destroyed by the moral disarmament of its youth by French schoolteachers. Sowell explains.
The once epic story of French soldiers' heroic defense at Verdun, despite the massive casualties they suffered, was now transformed into a story of horrible suffering by all soldiers at Verdun, from bullets, shells, poison gas, frostbite, presented in the much-sought-after spirit of impartiality. Imagine the life of these combatants, French, allies, or enemies. In short, men who had once been honored as patriotic heroes for having sacrificed their lives in a desperate struggle to hold off the invaders of their country were now verbally reduced to victims and put on the same plane as other victims among the invaders. Ceremonies dedicating monuments to commemorate soldiers who had died in battle were sometimes turned into occasions for speeches promoting the pacifist ideology. Among those who tried to warn against moral disarmament was Marshal Philippe Pétain, the victor of the Battle of Verdun, who in 1934 said that French teachers were out to raise our sons in ignorance of or in contempt of the fatherland. Years later, during the Second World War, one of the alerts issued to French soldiers said, "Remember the Marne and Verdun." But this was said to a generation that had been taught to see the Marne and Verdun not as historic sites of patriotic heroism by French soldiers, but as places where soldiers on all sides had been victims alike. France's behavior in the Second World War was an extraordinary contrast with its behavior in the First World War. France fought off the German invaders for 4 long years during the First World War, despite suffering horrendous casualties, more wartime deaths than a larger country like the United States has ever suffered in any war or in all its wars put together. Yet during the Second World War, France surrendered after just 6 weeks of fighting in 1940. In the bitter moment of defeat, the head of the teachers' union was told, "You are partially responsible for the defeat." Charles de Gaulle, François Mauriac, and many other Frenchmen blamed a lack of national will or general moral decay for the sudden and humiliating collapse of France in 1940. Although France's sudden collapse caught much of the world by surprise, Winston Churchill had said as far back as 1932, "France, though armed to the teeth, is pacifist to the core." Hitler was not surprised by France's sudden collapse, and had in fact predicted it. When he pressed his generals to draw up plans for the invasion of France immediately after the swift German victory in Poland in the autumn of 1939, the generals' analyses of the various military and logistical factors involved led them to doubt that such a project could be undertaken, with any realistic hope of success, before 1941, or perhaps even 1942. But the most delay that Hitler would grant them was until the spring of 1940, which in fact was when the German invasion of France began. Hitler's reasons were wholly different from the objective factors which German generals had analyzed. It was based on his analysis of the French themselves. Hitler said that France was no longer the same as the France that had fought doggedly through 4 years of the First World War, that the contemporary French were lacking in the personal strengths necessary for victory, and would falter and surrender. That is, in fact, largely what happened. The objective factors, such as the number and quality of military equipment available to France and its British allies versus those available to the German invaders, led military leaders in both France and Germany at the time to conclude at the outset that France had the greater prospects of victory. But Hitler had long made a study of public opinion, as well as official opinion, in France and Britain. The words and deeds of both politicians and pacifists in those countries went into Hitler's calculations.
The indoctrination of children into pacifism and moral disarmament brings to mind this Michael Jackson song from 1991. Here's "Heal the World."
Think about the generations and to say we want to make it a better place for our children and our children's children so that they know it's a better world for them and think if they can make it a better place.
There's a place in your heart, and I know that it is love. And this place is much brighter than tomorrow. And if you really try, you'll find there's no need to cry. In this place, you feel there's no hurt or sorrow. There are ways to get there if you care enough for the living. Make a little space, make a better place. Heal the world, make it a better place for you and for me and the entire human race. There are people dying. If you care enough for the living, make a better place for you and for me.
Cause number four, lack of deterrence. The fourth cause of World War II, according to Sowell, is a lack of appreciation of the importance of military and psychological deterrence among the British and French leaders and intellectuals. Sowell says this about the importance of deterrence.
Like virtually everyone else, intellectuals generally prefer peace to war. However, as already noted in Chapter 4, there are some very fundamental differences in ideas on how to prevent wars. Just as the vision of crime prevention among intellectuals goes back at least as far as the 18th century, so too does their vision of war and peace. In contrast to the tragic vision, which sees military strength as the key to deterrence, the vision of the intellectuals has long been one that relies on international negotiations and/or disarmament agreements to avoid wars.
Sowell points out that many agreements were signed between Germany and other countries between the two world wars. There was the Washington Naval Agreement of 1921, which was an arms agreement limiting the number and size of warships. There was the Kellogg-Briand Pact of 1928, which was little more than a written renunciation of war. War bad, peace good. There was also the Anglo-German Naval Agreement of 1935. Think about it. Right before he planned to take over the world, Herr Hitler himself was busy signing agreements with those he was planning to conquer. He did it with England, France, and even with Stalin in Russia. There's a famous newsreel of Neville Chamberlain getting off the plane after his visit to Germany, waving the piece of paper which he and Adolf Hitler had just signed. Chamberlain had that, "Look, Mom, I got all A's on my report card," look in his eyes. It was September 30th, 1938, and here's what Neville Chamberlain said.
First, I want to say that the settlement of the Czechoslovakian problem, which has now been achieved, is, in my view, only the prelude to a larger settlement in which all Europe may find peace. This morning, I had another talk with the German Chancellor, Herr Hitler. And here is the paper which bears his name upon it as well as mine. Some of you perhaps have already heard what it contains, but I would just like to read it to you. We, the German Führer and Chancellor, and the British Prime Minister have had a further meeting today and are agreed in recognizing that the question of Anglo-German relations is of the first importance for the two countries and for Europe. We regard the agreement signed last night and the Anglo-German naval agreement as symbolic of the desire of our two peoples never to go to war with one another again. We are resolved that the method of consultation shall be the method adopted to deal with any other questions that may concern our two countries, and we are determined to continue our efforts to remove possible sources of difference and thus to contribute to assure the peace of Europe. As Sowell later said,
among the many notions of the 1920s and 1930s that returned in the 1960s was the irrelevant claim that the peoples of all countries desire peace, as if what the German people desired mattered to Hitler, or what the Soviet peoples wanted mattered to Stalin.
In less than 1 year, Chamberlain would be declaring war on Germany, still not realizing that he could have done anything differently other than signing pieces of paper with the German Führer. Here's Chamberlain explaining his decision to declare war on Germany to the British people.
I am speaking to you from the cabinet room at 10 Downing Street. This morning, the British ambassador in Berlin handed the German government a final note stating that unless we heard from them by 11 o'clock, that they were prepared at once to withdraw their troops from Poland, a state of war would exist between us. I have to tell you now that no such undertaking has been received, and that consequently this country is at war with Germany. You can imagine what a bitter blow it is to me that all my long struggle to win peace has failed. Yet I cannot believe that there is anything more or anything different that I could have done and that would have been more successful. Up to the very last, it would have been quite possible to have arranged a peaceful and honorable settlement between Germany and Poland. But Hitler would not have it. He had evidently made up his mind to attack Poland, whatever happened. And although he now says he put forward reasonable proposals which were rejected by the Poles, that is not a true statement. The proposals were never shown to the Poles, nor to us. And though they were announced in the German broadcast on Thursday night, Hitler did not wait to hear comments on them, but ordered his troops to cross the Polish frontier the next morning. His action shows convincingly that there is no chance of expecting that this man will ever give up his practice of using force to gain his will. He can only be stopped by force. And we and France are today, in fulfillment of our obligations, going to the aid of Poland, who is so bravely resisting this wicked and unprovoked attack upon her people. We have a clear conscience. We have done all that any country could do to establish peace. But a situation in which no word given by Germany's ruler could be trusted, and no people or country could feel itself safe, had become intolerable. And now that we have resolved to finish it, I know that you will all play your part with calmness and courage.
It is clear now in hindsight that mere ink on paper could never have deterred Hitler from seeking to conquer his neighbors, and that it would take overwhelming force and the firebombing of Dresden, Berlin, and other German cities to finally bring Hitler to his knees, just as it took the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki to bring Japan to its knees. But Sowell argues that the best time for a strong military and moral deterrence is before a war starts and not after it's underway, because by then it might be too late. Cause number 5, anti-patriotism. One of the best chapters I have ever read in any Sowell book can be found in Intellectuals and Society. It's a chapter called Patriotism and National Honor. In this chapter, Sowell asks, then answers the question, how important is patriotism and national honor to the survival of a nation? As you might imagine, Sowell thinks it's crucial, and he makes the case that patriotism was viewed as suspect by intellectuals between the two world wars. Sowell says this.
Despite a tendency in some intellectual circles to see the nation as just a subordinate part of the world at large, some acting or even describing themselves as citizens of the world, patriotism is, in one sense, little more than a recognition of the basic fact that one's own material well-being, personal freedom, and sheer physical survival depend on the particular institutions, traditions, and policies of the particular nation in which one lives. There is no comparable world government, and without the concrete institutions of government, there is nothing to be a citizen of or to have enforceable rights, however lofty or poetic it may sound, to be a citizen of the world. When one's fate is clearly recognized as dependent on the surrounding national framework, the institutions, traditions, and norms of one's country, then the preservation of that framework cannot be a matter of indifference, while each individual pursues purely individual interests. Patriotism is a recognition of a shared fate and the shared responsibilities that come with it. National honor is a recognition that one-day-at-a-time rationalism is a delusion that enables politicians to escape the responsibilities of statesmanship. Conditions may become so repugnant in one country that it makes sense to move to another country, but there is no such thing as moving to the world. One may, of course, live in a country parasitically, accepting all the benefits for which others have sacrificed, both in the past and in the present, while rejecting any notion of being obliged to do the same. But once that attitude becomes general, the country becomes defenseless against forces of either internal disintegration or external aggression. In short, patriotism and national honor cannot be reduced to simply psychological quirks to which intellectuals can consider themselves superior, without risking dire consequences, of which France in 1940 was a classic example. It was considered chic in some circles in France of the 1930s to say, rather Hitler than Blum. But that was before they experienced living under Hitler, or dying after dehumanization in Hitler's concentration camps. Disdain for patriotism and national honor was just one of the attitudes among the intellectuals of the 1920s and 1930s to reappear with renewed force in Western democracies in the 1960s and afterwards. How far history will repeat itself on this and other issues is a question for the future to answer. Indeed, it is the question for the future of the Western world.
Cause number 6, citizen of the world-ism. Sowell explains how the concept of world citizenship became a high priority for teachers' unions in France between the two world wars. Sowell said this.
Addressing school teachers in 1919, Anatole France urged that they use the schools to promote pacifism and internationalism. In developing the child, you will determine the future, he said. The teacher must make the child love peace and its works. He must teach him to detest war. He will banish from education all that which excites hate for the stranger, even hatred of the enemy of yesterday, he added. Anatole France declared, "We must be citizens of the world or see all civilization perish." Such ideas became dominant in French schools during the next two decades.
The idea of world citizenship is still with us decades later. In 1985, a movement with a song took the world by storm, which perfectly expressed this notion of world citizenship. I had just graduated from college when the song came out, and I can't possibly exaggerate how much impact this video had. I remember my mother bought literally dozens of VHS tapes of the song's video, not to mention the accompanying t-shirts, to give out to everyone she knew. The star power behind this video is insane. The voices, my God, the voices, the passion, the emotional hypnotism. While this song was not about war, it was more about famine in Africa, but it still perfectly captures the emotional catharsis to be experienced by those who embrace citizenship of the world-ism. And let's not forget the hundreds of millions of dollars raised by this video, which I'm sure went to making a lot of clever people very rich. Ladies and gentlemen, we are the world.
There comes a time when we heed a certain call, when the world must come together as one.
There are people dying, oh, when it's time to lend a hand to life. The greatest gift of all.
We can't go on pretending day by day that someone somewhere will soon make a change.
We all are part of God's great big family.
And the truth, you know, love is all we need.
We are the world. We are the children. We are the ones who make a brighter day. So let's start giving. There's a choice we make.
So that's my summary of the key points of Sowell's essay, Intellectuals and War. I hope it has inspired you to read the whole book. It's truly life-changing. And now it's time to introduce today's very special guest, Victor Davis Hanson. Dr. Hanson is a classicist, a military historian, a farmer, and now a very successful political commentator. He knows more about classical history and the history of warfare than just about any living person. Literally. I'm not exaggerating for dramatic effect. One of the things that makes Dr. Hanson so fascinating to listen to is that he remembers just about everything he ever learned about history. And this superhuman memory enables him to see connections between trends and events that mere mortals like myself can only gasp in amazement at. Dr. Hanson has written over 20 books over the past 40 years. Most were academic works intended for a scholarly audience. Others, like the four I mentioned earlier, were intended for a general lay audience. If you haven't already read a Victor Davis Hanson book, now is the time to start. You'll be hooked just like I am. He has a new book coming out next year called The End of Everything: How Wars Descend into Annihilation. Not the most upbeat title, I'll admit, but I've already pre-ordered it anyway. Victor Davis Hanson, welcome to the Genius of Thomas Sowell podcast.
Thank you for having me.
A few months after I started this podcast devoted to the ideas of Thomas Sowell, I started having some success with it. Lots of people were listening. They were excited that there was a place to go to hear people talking about Sowell and his ideas. I was getting good reviews and daily emails from fans. And my wife got a little jealous of all the attention I was getting. And she told me that she was going to start a competing podcast called The Genius of Victor Davis Hanson. I thought you should know this might be coming down the pike at some point. I mentioned my wife for a reason, because there's something important in our story that you talk a lot about in all your books and on many of your podcasts. I'm a Jewish kid raised in Forest Hills, Queens. One side of my family came from Berlin, the other side from Vilnius in Lithuania. So I'm half Western and half Eastern European. My wife's family moved to the United States from India when she was only 8 years old. Her parents are both scientists with very successful careers. My wife was a top student, and we met in her senior year of college. She later became a lawyer. We got married, and we're now raising 4 daughters here in Los Angeles, not too far from your farm. There's a phrase you use often, which always rang a giant bell for me: assimilation, integration, and intermarriage. Please explain to us why our story is such a uniquely American story and why it's so important for this country.
Well, once the founders in their first official document signed the Declaration of Independence, that all men were equal under God, and race was not specifically mentioned in the Constitution, then the natural logic of the Constitution and these foundational documents were that people were people regardless of their ethnic background, racial background, gender. Now, of course, human nature being what it is, 95% of the founding population was from the British Isles, or a few from Western Europe. But gradually, with give and take, Sturm und Drang, that inclusivity was widened to Eastern Europeans, Southern Europeans, Asians. The problem with slavery was by fits and starts being addressed, people from Latin America. So the fulfillment, as Martin Luther King said, of the founder's promise was an ongoing process. And one of the things Martin Luther King said was, I'm not trying to be a revolutionary and tell you something that you don't want to hear. I'm just reminding you of what your country was based on, and I would like you to keep the promises of the founders, which was I thought that was a very persuasive argument when I heard it as a teenager. But for this multiracial democracy, constitutional republic that ensued, it was very important that we not tribalize. That's a natural order of things. Birds of a feather flock together, as Plato says. And so that required all of these immigrant groups to surrender, to some extent, their primary identity. And that meant we didn't ask them. We don't ask Americans to say, we want government as practice in India, jurisprudence and practice as Mexico, Bill of Rights, if it exists, as practice in Argentina. What we said was, you come here and you have to embrace the core unification principles of America. And in exchange for that, we feel we are enriched by first or second, third generation until you're fully assimilated by your food, by your fashion, by your literature, by your music. That mosaic is very important, but it doesn't infringe on the commonality that we all share as Americans. And so they understood very quickly on that we were in a paradox, that we were going to be the first multi-ethnic, multiracial democracy in history that was based on common principles and ideas. But on the other hand, the idea of natio, the Roman idea of nations, was originally predicated on blood and soil, sort of like Japan today or Germany or China, that people look like each other. So you and I, if we really like cheese China, and we say, I want to be a citizen of China, we will never be fully accepted because we do not look like Chinese. Same is true of most places in the world, but not in the United States. But that was a burden, or that was a challenge that required constant civic education and not to be prepared not to re-tribalize. And I think in this last generation, we've forgotten them.
How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? How many seas must the white dove sail before before she sleeps in the sand. Yes, and how many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
Blowing in the Wind by Bob Dylan is one of the all-time great anti-war songs. Who can forget these lyrics? How many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? How many years can some people exist before they're allowed to be free? Yes, and how many deaths will it take till he knows that too many people have died? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
Tell us a little bit about your relationship with Thomas Sowell, both with the man himself and also with his work.
I had followed his work a lot. I wrote a book, Carnage and Culture, and he had written a large book about culture as it pertained to different countries throughout the world as the primary definition of difference rather than race. And I had used that, footnoted it. And then when I retired from teaching at 49, I was offered a billet at the Hoover Institution. I'd written then about 10 or 12 books, but I was indistinguishable from the other senior fellows. But Tom Sowell communicated with me, I think, the year that I got there. And I guess it was because we have the Hoover Daily Report. You could read what everybody was writing, along with Shelby Steele. And so I'd say within 6 months of arrival, Tom suggested that we have lunch every 2 or 3 weeks when I came up. I live on a farm and I would have an apartment. And so for the next, until right before COVID, I would say for the next 15 years, we had a ritual that he and I met for lunch. And when Shelby was in town, the three of us, and because I was, he was writing and not coming in as much as I was because I was younger and more active in the universe, in the institution. Not that he wasn't, but he was doing more research than on institutional committees. Then I would always update him on what was going on at Hoover, and he would update me on what was going on research wise. And we got along pretty well. And then it was my responsibility every once in a while. He was very private, but he would suggest to me, well, I see there's some good fellows. Would you bring one along? So over the years, I would bring generals or admirals or thinkers, and the three of us would eat. And sometimes I would bring military. He was especially fond of military officers, and we had a program. So for at least 10 years, it was a ritual that the colonels that were up for generalship that took a year at the Hoover Institution, I would bring the four of them along for once a year, and Tom would talk to them. And then the other thing was, he's a very accomplished photographer. So once in a while, he would go to Yosemite. And on the way to Yosemite, I would meet him somewhere in Fresno or Clovis. Did that a number of times. And we would communicate by email, occasionally by phone calls. I would go to his home. Tom is an intensely private person, and he has to be given the number of people who are interested in talking to him. And I haven't met anybody in my professional career that has more of a public following. Literally, he gets hundreds of requests every month to speak. He gets people who call up. He gets people who try to show up at his house. And it means that he has to be, I think, very careful with his time. So we scripted these lunches very carefully. And I think it was a benefit to both of us. And after COVID, and because Tom is in his 90s now, we haven't done it as much, but I think we will. We also met every Christmas with Shelby Steele and another person for 15 years to have Christmas dinner, 2 or 3 days after Christmas between New Year's in Palo Alto.
Where have all the flowers gone? Long time passing. Where have all the flowers gone? Long time ago. Where have all the flowers gone? Young girls have picked them.
Have All the Flowers Gone by Peter, Paul, and Mary is masterfully constructed to create the image of a never-ending cycle of futility. Where have all the flowers gone? Young girls pick them, every one. Where have all the young girls gone? Gone for husbands, every one. Then the husbands become soldiers, the soldiers end up in graveyards, then the graveyards return to flowers. And so the cycle continues forever and ever. When will we ever learn?
When I post Sowell quotes on Twitter, I very often hear people call him a national treasure. I'm sure you've heard that before. Now, there aren't too many other people who are called that nowadays. I have two questions for you about that. Number one, is there anyone else on the right or the left who people now or historically have called a national treasure? And number two, what is it about Sowell that causes people to think of him this way? What is his secret sauce?
Well, I don't think there is anybody that has that stature. And I think the first reason that he does, he's deceptively common sense and acceptable. So he writes in a prose style that's acceptable, and he's data-driven. And one of the hallmarks of his research is to expose fallacies, hypocrisies, false knowledge. And how does he do that? Through inductive logic and data. And he makes that accessible to people. And so if you're interested or disturbed or confused by a phenomenon that has swept the country, whether it's transgenderism, for example, now, or whether it was 10 years ago, whether it was modern monetary theory, or whether it was the woke movement, you could go to Tom Sowell and he would not get emotional about it, either pro or con, but rather he would dissect it analytically in a series of either op-eds, occasional longer essays, podcasts or interviews, or more importantly, in a book. That was one thing. And the other thing about him was he was totally fearless. In other words, he was not bothered at all. I've never known him to take a position based on what he perceived as the majority position or a position that might enhance him career-wise or financially. He doesn't care. He's a contrarian. He will say what he believes if he believes that it can be documented or backed up by it. He's an economist. He's data-driven. So that means that a lot of people misunderstand that. A lot of people in the Black community, because he is not convinced that massive government programs have helped the Black community, they feel, therefore, he is not helping them in their careerist aspirations as part of that government project, and therefore they get angry at him. He's not angry at them. He's just saying, this is a misallocation of resources. And you would all be better to switch allegiances and look at other cultural problems or challenges rather than government solution. But that's misinterpreted. So he gets a lot of hostility from both Black activists, but also from white liberals, because white liberals in a very condescending fashion, and he's written about this, feel that because they're advocates of traditional big government solutions for minorities, therefore minorities owe them some type of loyalty or fides. And when they don't express that subservience, then they get angry, as if you don't appreciate it or you're uppity. It's very ironic, as Tom has pointed out, because much of the attitude of the white liberal is reminiscent of the Southern segregationists that suggests that Black people should not have an independent voice and that they are beneficiaries of a paternalism that they don't appreciate.
You mentioned before that Dr. Sowell liked to have lunch with military leaders with you. And it reminds me of when I first read Intellectuals in Society, Sowell talks about the intellectual atmosphere in France and England between the two world wars and how the attitude of pacifism led Hitler to believe he could easily defeat those two countries, and that deterrence had somehow been lost. And it opened my mind up to the idea of the importance of psychological deterrence to preventing war. And you're an expert on war. Sowell quotes you in that book. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like Sowell got a lot of his understanding about World War II and the Vietnam War, which he also talks about in that book, from his association with you?
We talk about deterrence, pacifism, appeasement almost in every conversation. And he introduced me to a lot of thought that I was not aware of. And then in turn, I would try to steer the conversation to classical authors, both in the antiquity and also in the present, that might enhance our own understanding of war, because we shared almost identical views about it. I remember a conversation where I tried to talk about Geoffrey Blainey, the Australian military historian, who I thought was a genius, but it was unduly not recognized as such, at least not commiserate with his work. And almost immediately, Tom said, that is right. And I just said that war breaks out when nobody knows the relative power of the belligerents involved. And then therefore they make bad judgments based on faulty data. Of course, when you say faulty data, Tom's eyes light up. And then he would interrupt me and say, well, exactly. On the eve of World War II, the Russians were appeasing. And I had talked about this in the Second World Wars. And the Russians were collaborating. The Americans were isolationists. And the British and French were appeasing. And that gave the false impression to Hitler and Mussolini that these economies or these militaries or these manpower reserves were not sufficient to fight them. When in fact, an empirical assessment said, don't get these people angry, because in the aggregate, they have 20 times the manpower, 10 times the GDP, and therefore war broke out. And therefore, as Tom has written, it's very important for everybody concerned in a disagreement to show relative strength and power so no one makes a false assumption. And I think that if you look at Ukraine, one of the reasons that Vladimir Putin went in, that he falsely conjectured, given statements by Barack Obama and Seoul during a hot mic, tell Vladimir that if this is my last election, if he gives me space, I'll dismantle basically missile defense. And he took that as a sign of weakness. He took it as a sign of weakness when George W. Bush was bogged down in Iraq in his last year in office, when he went into Georgia and Ossetia. And so he went into Ukraine in 2014 when Joe Biden said that if it was a minor offensive, he wouldn't react to Ukraine, or, hey, Vladimir, do not hack humanitarian institutions, or whatever it was. Tom, I think, and we discussed that at length, but I think he's written about it persuasively, that when you suggest that you're not as strong as you actually are, two things happen. The opponent then becomes emboldened, but more importantly, and Tom is very good on this, this is a theme in all of his work, they develop a contempt for you that you will not exercise a power that's at your disposal. So they, you know, Hitler said after the Munich Agreement, after he got almost everything he wanted, he said, I would like to jump up and down on Chamberlain and smash that guy in his umbrella. He was angry that, here was Britain with the biggest navy in the world, and they were appeasing Hitler of all people. And where if it had been Hitler, he would have used that power. So, and Tom he's very good on that idea that Western powers have to exhibit or make known to enemies what they're capable of if they're pushed, and that will keep the peace.
What's wrong with the world, mama? People living like they ain't got no mamas. I think the whole world's addicted to the drama. Only attracted to things that'll bring the trauma. Overseas, yeah, we trying to stop terrorism. But we still got terrorists here living in the USA, the big CIA, the Bloods and the Crips and the KKK. But if you only have love for your own race, then you only leave space to discriminate. And to discriminate only generates hate. And when you hate, then you're bound to get irate. Yeah, madness is what you demonstrate. And that's exactly how anger works and operates. Man, you gotta have love just to set it straight. Take control of your mind and meditate. Let your soul gravitate to the love, y'all, y'all.
People killing, people dying, children hurt and you hear them crying. Can you practice what you preach, and would you turn the other cheek? Father, 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 help us, send some guidance from above. These people got me questioning, where is the love?
Where is the love? Where is the love? Where is the love?
Where is the love by Black Eyed Peas? Nations dropping bombs, chemical gases filling lungs of little ones, with ongoing suffering as the youth die young. So ask yourself, is the lovin' really gone? Where is the love?
Really, what is going wrong in this world that we living in? People keep on giving in, making wrong decisions, only visions of them dividends. Not respecting each other, denying thy brother. A war's going on, but the reason's undercover. The truth is kept secret, it's swept under the rug. If you never know truth, then you never know love. Where's the love, y'all? Come on.
I don't know.
Where's the truth, y'all? Come on.
I don't know.
Where's the love, y'all?
People killing, people dying, children hurting, even crying. When you practice what you preach, and what you turn the other cheek. Father, 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 help us. Some guidance from above. These people got me questioning. Where is the love?
Where is the love?
It reminds me of all the communist dictatorships with their military parades, with all the missiles and the lockstep marching soldiers. They're actually just trying to create good old-fashioned deterrence.
They are, and they are with another thing that Tom and I talked about was that, and we had discussions about Kim Jong-un, and we were always talking about craziness as being an advantage in nuclear poker. So we were kind of frustrated during the Obama administration and early Biden administration, and even in the Bush administration, where we went to great pains to reassure our potential adversaries that we were sober and judicious and didn't take chances while they were threatening to nuke us. Iran was saying Israel was a one-bomb state. Kim Jong-un said that Portland was in his sights. Xi was saying that he could take Taiwan. And they were acting as if they were crazy, and that was scaring us. Putin is doing it now in Ukraine. And then when Donald Trump came along, who I don't think Tom was a big fan of his originally, or maybe not ultimately, but he did acknowledge that Trump's feigned erratic behavior, I think it was feigned, I have a bigger button than he does, et cetera, was of some advantage because Kim Jong-un for the first time thought, I don't know what the United States is capable of, but I do know they have a lot more capability than I'll ever dream of. And we had a peace. Tom is very empirical, and that's what I like with this long relationship, that he was not wedded to particular doctrines. He was an inductive thinker. And if he didn't like Donald Trump, he didn't support him in the nomination. If, as he saw him govern, and he aligned with some of Tom's principles, then he had a begrudging respect for him, and he would admit that. And so that was pretty interesting to watch him.
I remember I actually had a falling out with Thomas Sowell in 2015 because he was very much convinced that Trump, first of all, that he couldn't win the Republican nomination, and secondly, that he would be a disaster if he got elected. And I did not agree with those two sentiments, so it caused somewhat of a rift in my mind. You know, friends of mine would say to me, Alan, even Thomas Sowell doesn't like Trump. You know, are you sure you're making the right decision with that guy? Now, you wrote a book, The Case for Trump. So you came out making strong arguments why Donald Trump was on the right track for America. And at the same time, Thomas Sowell was saying he'd be a total disaster if elected. Did that create some sort of a wedge or a falling out between you and him at the time?
I don't think so, because he read that book. And actually, the title of that book that was submitted to Basic Books was not a very good title on my part. It was called How Trump Won. And I had a very gifted liberal editor, Laura Heimer, and she said, you want to get this out message out? If you do, you're going to have to be more direct. So I'm suggesting we call it The Case for Trump. As soon as that book came out, Case of Trump, people thought it was a 110% endorsement. But what it really was the discussion of a tragic hero, that a person who had particular skill sets that were needed at the time on the border, on the economy, on foreign policy, on dealing with China and Russia and terrorism and ISIS. And yet the very methodologies that he would use and the language he employed would alienate the beneficiaries of his policy. And I invoke John Ford movies, Sophocles, Tragic Heroes. And so the tragic hero was always someone who would do great benefit for the community, but because of character flaws, or at least perceived flaws by the establishment, they would never get recognition for what they did. They would never end well. They were all, and I had written that. I think it was a little bit prescient because I said at the end of that book, Donald Trump's not going to end well. As Shane doesn't end well, as the Magnificent Seven doesn't, as John Wayne and the Searchers doesn't end well, as Ajax doesn't, or Oedipus or Antigone, etc. And so when we talked about Trump, Tom is very literary, and he's interested in almost any aspect of inquiry or knowledge. So he would talk about Greek tragedy, and he was interested in this theme. And so I would try to explain what bothered Tom about Donald Trump was that I know that Tom has a reputation of being eccentric, sometimes stubborn, not unwilling to change. If an editor says you have to change a sentence, he won't do it. If somebody says you have to do this, he won't do it. But the fact is, he really is a believer in traditional manners and diction and decorum. So when you go to a restaurant or you see him, he's absolutely polite to people. He's dignified. He's well-spoken. And he expects that type of behavior in people that see him. And if he's not accorded that behavior, he will be very angry. And so when he saw Donald Trump, he was angry at Donald Trump's appearance. He was angry at Donald Trump's diction. He was angry at Donald Trump's rudeness. He did not like his tweets. And he said, this person doesn't have the decorum that a leader needs. And I said, that's why he's a tragic hero, because he has the analyses of what's wrong and the solutions that could correct those defects. And he's brought in by the people to do that. But at some magical moment when he starts to be effective and people can give a sigh of relief, well, we finally are getting the border closed. We've got 2% GDP. We've got 3.5% unemployment. We have only 2% inflation. Maybe we now have the luxury to concentrate or focus on his defects, his language, his tweeting. And that was intricate. And so that's how that discussion about Donald Trump progressed. And then I think the other thing is, Tom is a very fair person. So even though he was not initially fond of Trump, when he looked at the Russian collusion hoax, the laptop disinformation hoax, the first impeachment that was rushed through after, he finally got to the point where he said, this is not empirical. This is just excused by somebody's irrational hatred of Donald Trump. And they're setting standards, or they're setting new norms that are going to come back to haunt them. And I had talked about third book of Thucydides ad nauseum with him about what happened in Corcyra, that when you destroy the norms of a society for short-term gain, you never really believe that you're going to need them as a refuge for your own protection. And now we see that that's going to happen to the Democrats. They're very angry about the possibility of impeachment. They're very angry about mental acuity tests for Biden, all the things they insisted on for Trump.
Trump, the tragic hero, has not yet gotten on his horse and ridden into the sunset. We're going to get Trump 2.0. And could you release the case for Trump again with a revamped version?
Well, I wrote an aftermath, but I think no president in my understanding of 45 presidency has suffered the indignities that he has. We have never had a president impeached twice. We've never had a president tried as a private citizen. We've never had a president facing 91 indictments. We've never had a president where the popular culture, with complete impunity, said they would like celebrities of the popular culture said with complete impunity, which is a free society. Okay, but I want to blow up the White House. I want to decapitate him. I want to stab him to death. I want to shoot him to death. I want to blow him up. I want to put him in a cage. I'm quoting verbatim everybody from Madonna to Kathy Griffith to the late Peter Fonda. And so that level of invective and that hatred and what the state is doing to him is very tragic, because, you know, they don't do it to anybody else. And it's irrational because it's not based on data that is provable that warrants this type of treatment. And I think that's kind of what they do to people like Donald Trump. And I don't think he's aware of it. He's always trying to say this is unfair. This is not right. And you want to say to him, of course it's not right, because you came in on your horse without any political experience and you incurred the wrath of the bipartisan establishment. And then, unlike most Republican of the Bob Dole, John McCain, Mitt Romney, Bush brand, you tried to radically change it. And that radical change offended everybody from the Never Trumpers to the Romneyites to the left, et cetera. And then they concentrated on the methodologies by which you enacted successful change. And therefore, you were found wanting and they were going to punish you. And what did you expect? But it was almost like Donald Trump was adolescent, like he was saying, why are they doing this? I tried to get the vaccinations out quickly with Operation Warp Speed. Why did they not allow, why did Pfizer delay the announcement that the vaccinations were working until after my election when they knew they were working? I had promised to tell people in October. Or don't they understand that you can't impeach a president for a call that has a legitimate worry about corruption of the Biden family? And even today, he makes all of these statements as if he's living in a rational world. He's not. And I think that's what's tragic about it. You want to say, Donald, these people despise you because you're capable. You have certain skill sets, crude as they are to many people, that are effective and can enact change that's going to be to their detriment. And therefore, they're going to destroy you always. You may want to meet with Candace Owens or Kanye West and have a program to decriminalize drug abuses for marginalized people in the prison system. You may want to reach out on Green Initiative. It won't work. It will not work. The left hates you. They will always hate you. And that's just the way it is.
Since we've been talking about Donald Trump, and they were always telling us that Trump was going to get us into World War III, I thought I would play Richard Wagner's Ride of the Valkyries, which is the kind of music that always puts me in the mood to invade Poland.
One theme which both you and Sol share in common is a keen understanding of the dichotomy between intellectual elites and everyday people. This was the theme of Sol's Intellectuals and Society, and it's also a major theme of your last book, The Dying Citizen. Here's a quote from that book. Intellectuals and the elite in general are especially prone to the globalist disconnect, most idealistically a concern for global well-being amid local intractable pathologies, most truthfully, at worst, an end of history megalomaniac impulse to solve innate problems on a grand scale once and for all. Tell us why this is such an important concept for people to understand.
Tom came to that idea, I think, growing up poor and often in foster care, a Black person during the 50s. And I didn't have that type of environment, but I grew up in a very poor area. I had very good parents. We had my grandparents were farmers. We farmed, and he was exposed to a very different academic world, and I was too. So when I, even to this day, when I leave Selma, California, where I'm speaking today, and I go to Palo Alto, it's like going to a different planet. And so, first of all, you're not part of the intellectual world. At least you don't live with them, and you don't have the same values with them. So you start to study them abstractly and how they operate. That's a gift. And Tom does that. I do too. And what we've talked about a lot, because he's very interested in psychology, believe it or not, not pop psychology, but classical psychology. And what we would always talk about is, why do these people adopt these radical positions that are never subject to themselves? Why do they insist that teachers' unions are great, charter schools are bad, but their kids are in, when we were talking, he would say they're over there in Sacred Heart, they're at Castalea, they're at the Menlo School, they're not down in Fresno, they're not in East Palo Alto. Why do they say that we have to have kilowatt prices at 35 cents or 40 cents per kilowatt when it's 70 degrees in Palo Alto, but it's 110 in Bakersfield, or it's, you know, minus something up in the Sierra? So we were interested in these contradictions. And then we would ask ourselves, well, why did they do this? Is it just that they're hypocrites? And I think we both agreed in these long talks that there's some medieval idea of penance almost that they do not feel comfortable. This is something that Tom really has pointed out about the anointed, the visions of the anointed, that they do not feel comfortable with working class people and people who are not, even not white. And they feel in the abstract terribly guilty about that. So they do penance by being hyper left or being radically left. And they think that from their salon or from Malibu or from Palo Alto, the more radical, the more intolerant they are of any other position that's not almost Marxist, the more that it leaves them of the guilt that they're not associating with the people, their constituents. You could really see that with the illegal immigration. It was okay as long as the 7 million were in Texas. The moment these governors in Florida, Texas, Arizona wised up and started sending them to Martha's Vineyard, Chicago, New York, after the initial ebullition of the people, oh, we love people, they became almost neo-Confederate-like. We want them out. We want them out. Get rid of them. Eric Adams, these people are destroying New York. Martha's Vineyard, they sort of gave them nice little care packages and then got a bus to get them out. And now they're all, are actually saying, well, we want them to come illegally without background checks, 7 million at a big in a 2-year period, perhaps, but they have to stay in Texas. There's no more busing. So we're going to move the border from Texas, Mexico to Texas, maybe Arkansas, the new border. And in other words, it's what Tom has written about a lot, that once they're subject to the consequences of their own bankrupt ideology, they go nuts and they panic and they're deer in the headlights. And that means that these intellectuals have never been around the working class. They don't associate with them. They never been around minorities. They don't want to be around them. And they create an abstract edifice to square that circle of their apartheid.
Let's talk about Sowell's new book, Social Justice Fallacies.
Yes.
Where do you see this new book in the context of Sowell's larger body of work? And what do you think are the main arguments of the book?
Well, he has five chapters on, he presents a typology of fallacies. There's rigid views, chess piece fallacy, that can't be changed, racial fallacies, class fallacies. And what he's doing is, as he in his 90s looked at this woke phenomenon, he was both, I guess, has a sense of despair because it was all so bankrupt and also illogical, and there was so much data out there to refute this. But he also knew that people needed to be reminded of that. So he went back to his economic, his cultural, his racial work, and he took a chapter and put it into the context of this current craziness. And he wanted to remind, that's the purpose of the book. And the main theme of all of these prior work and present is kind of Alexis de Tocqueville's idea that most people would rather all be equal and poor or better off, with some more better off than others. And that is an element of human nature, and it explains this irrationality. The thing about Tom, he's a very eclectic reader. So if he's writing about a particular racial or economic disparity and the bankrupt ideas to address it, he will be reading novels or he'll be reading scientific. So he brings in things, just weird stuff that you wouldn't be, that in the 1950s or during the 40s, when they were giving examinations to soldiers, that blacks from urban areas were having higher scores than whites from rural areas to prove the point that geography and culture matter more than race. I was reading this the last week, and I wrote something down that I thought was pretty interesting, that he says things such as, why do some people excel within families? And it turns out the firstborn child excels. And that is because the parent, in the initial euphoria of having a child after having no child, lavishes. And we knew that, but we didn't see it spelled out with data to support it. And why does he bring that up? To show as an example, if you are going to unleash the power of the state to insist on an equality of result, you're going to have such power and such dangerous power that you're going to destroy the country, because it would have to be taken to the absurdity of going into the individual family and saying, oh, all firstborn are, they have privilege, and it's because of bias of the parents, and therefore we're going to make every parent not get excited about their firstborn. And then by analysis, he extends that, and that's the argument they're using with women and minorities. But he takes something that is self-evident. Another theme that he's bringing back, and this is common, as you know, through all of his work, is he looks at the viability of the Black family, marriage rates, divorce rates, illegitimacy rates from, let's say, 1945 to 1964. And it pretty much mirror images, with certain allowances for Jim Crow and segregation in the South and de facto discrimination often in the North. But it does shadow the white experience. And then you hit 1964 and 1965, and he says two things happened. And that's thematic in his new book, in different bits and pieces. The white elites sort of culturally experimented and attacked all of the reference of stability. They went after the marriage, the nuclear family. They green-lighted drug use. They green-lighted illegitimacy, fornication, etc. And his argument was twofold. And that had disastrous effects on poor people who emulated the elite but did not have the wherewithal in extremis to find a corrective or a sanctuary for these pathologies. And two, the Great Society, especially the 1964 and 1965 and then legislation, but going on into housing and education, human nature being what it is, it told the Black community that this country owes you something, and they're going to have repertory money, repertory programs, and you do not have to do what you did in the 50s. In other words, strong families in adversity. And that has been disastrous. He leaves open to controversy whether this was deliberate or whether it was just an artifact of well-meaning people who were stupid and naive. But it's very clear that he feels that there was an abyss between pre-civil rights legislation and after civil rights legislation. And sometimes Shelby would come to lunch and he said, well, you know, Tom, this is white guilt. He wrote a book on that as well. Shelby did. So I don't know if they really ever decided, Tom, whether this was a pernicious pre-planned idea to wreck the Black family, or it was just stupid people. But in this new book, he has this one chapter on knowledge fallacies. And when you get through with it, it's typical Tom. It's people who say they have expertise, they have titles before, letters after their name, and they make these arguments from authority. They can be very dangerous people because they're not empirical and they're not out with the people who's are going to experience the effect of their abstractions. And so it's I guess to sum up, it's a compilation of all of his prior works, but focus on what is most bothersome today in the year 2023.
Sometimes I lay under the moon. I thank God I'm breathing, and I pray don't take me soon, 'cause I am here for a reason.
Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds, I know someday it'll all turn around, because
I don't know if you know this song, but it's one of my all-time favorite anti-war songs, called One Day, by a singer named Matis Yahu. All my life, I've been waiting for, I've been praying for the people to say that we don't want to fight no more, there'll be no more wars, and our children will play.
Sometimes in my tears I drown.
Well, yeah, I mean, unfortunately, he stopped writing columns, you know, several years ago. So we didn't have the benefit of his wisdom during the whole Trump presidency, BLM phase, Me Too movement. Like, we didn't have him as a voice in the background, you know, so we've been waiting with bated breath for this book. I know we're running out of time now, but I have one final question for you, not about Sowell, about you. A couple of years ago, you led a historical trip to Israel.
Yes.
My wife and I really wanted to go with you, but we have four young kids, and it just wasn't logistically possible at the time to come. And I've heard you're not doing those guided trips anymore. Is there any way I can convince you to offer at least one more trip?
Well, I'm doing one. We had 2 years of hiatus, actually, because of COVID. And that meant that we honored our commitment. So people who had paid and then found the trip canceled, we gave credit for the next year. But there was no next year because they canceled it again. And so we kind of took an economic hit. But we did go last year to Israel, and we said that would be the last one. I'm 70 now, and I started this when I was 49 with my partner and friend, Al Philip. And then I got COVID on May 1st of last year and got long COVID. So I had problems with taste, smell, hearing. It was a neuro autoimmune response. I didn't think I was going to be up to what would be required, kind of fatigue, flu-like, for over a year. But suddenly, maybe 3 months ago, I started feeling better, radically better. And almost back to normal. So we decided to go to the 80th anniversary of Normandy next year. So we're taking, I think, 160 people or 150. We have 400 on the waiting list. And now Al is trying to convince me to do one more. So we may do a military history of Eastern Europe or somewhere. The Israel trip was very successful. I had been in contact. I've known Ido Netanyahu, the prime minister's brother, for quite some time. He's visited my farm. So we had him speak. And then we had Bibi Netanyahu himself give a private lecture at the King David Hotel to our group. And with questions, he was very magnanimous. He was very funny. He said he would be prime minister by November of last year. And he was absolutely right. So it was a big hit. I think a lot of people, we could have taken, on that one, we probably could have taken 400 or 500 given the interest, but a lot of people were very interested. I tried to bring Israeli people from the IDF, their national security advisor, three-star generals, some with different political views, but I think a lot of people were wondering, will the Western disease of leisure and affluence and complacency and self-criticism taken to nihilism, will it eventually affect Israel, or it has already when you see these disputes? And if it does, do the Israelis see that they're an outpost of the West with no margin of error, that we can do this and be destructive in Europe, the United States, for a time, given we have no existential enemies, but they live in a neighborhood in which any sign of social decay or dissension can be rapidly exploited by their enemies. So they have to have a sort of hyper-Western confidence that's not existent in other countries anymore. And that's what fascinates people about Israel. How do they do that? Do they do it with politics, with religion, with memories of the Holocaust? How do they do it? And how have they done it so long? And can they keep it up as they become very, very successful and affluent? And so I went to Israel again this year, and I was surprised. It's just striking that each time you go there, I think I've been there 3 or 4 times, how affluent it is and how the economy has been unleashed, and all of the old worries about, will they have enough water? Will they have enough natural gas? Will they have enough oil? They're exporting it. They're giving their water from desalinization to Jordan. They want to export natural gas to Europe. They've almost solved all their existential problems. You look at their freeways, their infrastructure. It's just booming. And it's not the Israel that I remember during the suicide attacks of 2005 and 2006 when I went there. Another thing that you see very evidently, that our pathologies don't seem to exist there. So they don't have, you don't have cars as you do in San Francisco with signs on it, door unlocked, nothing of value, or smash and grab, or you don't go into a drugstore where you have screens where everything is locked up. Or you don't see people defecating, fornicating, urinating, injecting on the street in front of you. And that makes people very curious how they've avoided those Western pathologies. So every time I go there, I'm more and more bewildered about how it exists in that neighborhood, even as you can make the argument that even as it becomes more powerful, more confident, more successful, the envy, the resentment, and the hostility grow. So you have Europe today that's pretty much pro-Palestinian. You have the Democratic Party today. If you look at what the Squad, to take one example, has said, or that they have map, I think AOC had a map in her office with no Israel on it. So there's a lot of hostility toward Israel. And Iran, if this administration is hell-bent on getting back the Iran deal or giving them $6 billion, Iran will have a nuclear weapon. It's pretty clear within a year or two. It doesn't now already have one. So the more successful it becomes, the more dangerous its predicament, in some sense, or at least the hostility to it. I've never quite understood that, but it's there. I think a lot of it's envy and anger about their success, but that's another story.
Victor Davis Hanson, thank you so much for joining me on the Genius of Thomas Sowell podcast.
Thank you for having me.
This has been episode 37 of the Genius of Thomas Sowell podcast. If you like this podcast and want to support the work we are doing, introducing more and more people to the ideas of Thomas Sowell, there are many ways you can help. Rate and review this podcast on Apple Podcasts. Tell your friends about Sowell and the podcast. Support us on Patreon. Purchase our Thomas Sowell Post-it Notes. Follow me on Twitter for daily Sowell quotes and to connect with other fans of You Know Who. For now, just sit back and enjoy one of the greatest anti-war songs ever written, The Flesh Failures, from the musical Hair. Thanks for listening.